Yeah. The makeup room. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming. We're delighted to have Dr. David Nabarro with us here today. He doesn't have a whole lot of time, so David, if you have some opening remarks, we will give you the floor, and then we'll take some questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Stefan. Colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I have wanted to meet with you because at the end of last week, I returned to Europe and the US from visiting the four countries that are now affected by the Ebola outbreak. I went to Guinea, then Sierra Leone, Liberia, and then Mali. And I thought I'd talk with you briefly about what I've seen. I have to start by saying I was really inspired by the progress since I last visited the region, which was in September. Big shifts in the quality and coverage of the response. I think now we can see that the outbreak is actually a collection of a large number of small outbreaks all over the affected countries. Possibly as many as 100 different outbreaks, all at varying stages of evolution, all with different intensity. And in some of the areas, if you go down to the district or the chieftain level, we see the numbers of new cases reducing day by day, and in a few of them, the number is still on the increase. In order to address these variations, the response is now being adapted to the intensity of transmission as well as to the context within which it's taking place. So you have a slightly different response in a border area compared with an interior rural area, and a very different response in urban areas compared with rural areas. In all cases, we're most likely to see reduction in the number of new people infected if communities are fully involved. I call it now synchronized, localized implementation to combat Ebola. Synchronized, bringing people together, localized, because it's very much adjusted to the local level, and implementation, because for me now, the absolute emphasis is on doing the work as well as we can, getting into communities, identifying people who are ill, making sure they're treated, getting the contacts identified, and then keeping them under surveillance to see if they get ill too. Now, in Sierra Leone, in the east of the country, which used to be really intense, now transmission has reduced. Whereas in the west of the country, Freetown and Port Loko, there is quite intense transmission, and we're concentrating very much on trying to get things moving quickly in that area. We've also got concern about Guinea, particularly the interior of Guinea, Guinea Forestier, and in the area to the north towards the border with Mali, Siguri. And I want to stress that the communities everywhere are really beginning to own the outbreak and to respond. But in some cases, they're still quite frightened. And so often there has to be a negotiation between the responders and communities to get in and work with them. Without that negotiation, there can be a breakdown, there can be distress, and sometimes that leads to confrontation. Now, this outbreak will end when there is no more Ebola transmission in the region. And we also will need to wait for quite a lot of days to ensure that that really is the last case. And so we're going to be in this work for quite a lot more months. But I am confident from what I've seen that we're going in the right direction. I'd like to make a number of other specific comments that may be of interest to you. There's certainly things that have interested me. I think the people working on this response, thousands of people, people from the region, people from outside, really are amazing because they are putting their lives on the line. They are continuing the effort. Sometimes they just want to stay and go on because they feel they can't stop until the job is done. And so I'm delighted that yesterday Time magazine honoured Ebola responders as Person of the Year. I'm saddened that so many of these good people have got ill, and I'm troubled that many of them have died, because I think that that really does show me and show you the risks that they are facing themselves because of their commitment to trying to help others. Secondly, I want to talk about coordination. And I particularly want to talk about our own system, the UN system. I think that we're seeing a very high level of coordination in a complex response. And although from time to time there are moments when different organisations feel frustrated or delays are identified, the general image that I have is that government, donors, UN found family and NGOs are pulling on well together. I went to Nzerakore in the interior of Guinea, and I found a treatment centre that was an extraordinary example of how cooperation is occurring. It was built by the World Food Programme over 25 days of 24-hour working with money from the European Union on a site that was newly prepared. The NGO that will run the centre, also supported with external finance, is headed by a doctor from Niamey in Niger, who I've known actually for some years. It's supported by Red Cross volunteers, Médecins Sans Frontières, and other African and European NGOs. But the majority of the staff are local Guineans who are being taught how to work in it. Additional finance has come from the Secretary General's Trust Fund. But it just shows you, when you go, you find what a lot of people there are. I arrived, as well as finding the doctor from Niamey, another doctor I've worked with from Médecins Sans Frontières for years, and then other staff who I've worked with in different emergencies, and asked them all how they felt about this. And the sense amongst everybody is, I'm so pleased to be working on this. It's so important. I met teams from South Africa running laboratories, from Cuba providing treatment, from China running a treatment centre and providing other support, from the African Union coming in large numbers to help, from Japan, from Korea. I met people from all over Europe and the US. And within the UN family, I watch how WHO is providing the direction for the whole response, helping us with the epidemiology. I'll test your spelling of that word, epidemiology, which is the study of disease outbreaks. And they're there in huge number, more than 300 epidemiologists all over the region, working also on the contact tracing, supported by the UN Population Fund on contact tracing, the World Food Programme providing food assistance to more than 2 million people, but also running the whole logistics operation that gets right in to the villages and towns to ensure that people and material can be distributed. I am very pleased with UNICEF doing wonderful work on social mobilisation and community care. I see OCHA helping with coordination and with information management, and UNDP right at the centre of the effort to ensure that essential services are provided and that there is progress towards economic and other forms of recovery. and unmirror this totally unusual new mission is there to provide the strongest possible coordination and links with local government and national government. Also, I wanted to talk a little bit about the private sector, because one of the conclusions that I had is that the stabilisation of the impact of Ebola, which is huge, leading to a big reduction in gross domestic product, for example, in Sierra Leone, from 11% per year to 4% per year, that to get stabilisation and to get recovery, businesses are key, whether they're involved in mining or agriculture or services or tourism or transport. Without business, recovery won't happen. And I've today met representatives of more than 200 businesses who are focusing on how they can contribute to the Ebola response. Private investment in the response of cash and in-kind is more than $300 million US. And this is impressive and unprecedented, mobilized in less than 3 months. And there's an amazing group called the Ebola Private Sector Mobilization Group, started with just a handful of committed people. Now, as far as I can understand, with more than 60 companies involved, all finding ways to look after employees and families and communities through social mobilization. And they tell me that the Ebola infection rate among their employees and their communities is much lower than elsewhere. And I'm particularly impressed with the Paul G. Allen Foundation contributing $100 million towards the response with a very careful selection of projects with NGOs, with the CDC Foundation, with a number of groups who are involved in behaviour change, media groups and communications organisations, research and development for new treatments, and particularly important for us, they're helping with medical evacuation for people who've got Ebola, with an overall contribution of around $8 million US dollars. Special people. And this, by the way, is the Paul G. Allen Foundation Ebola Solidarity Ribbon. I've got one, which I can give to you if you want, because I can always get another. But I'm very keen that if you like it, you wear it, because it's very special. And that's what we need to be focusing on. And then I thought I'd just finish off by saying, from my perspective, really the most important group who I wish to... Oh, here's my spare one. Here you are. From my perspective, the group that I want to stay really closely involved with on this issue is yourselves, because actually this is a story of tragedy and misery, because there have been so many people affected by the outbreak. But it's a story of solidarity and hope because of the hundreds of millions of people who've been involved in the response. And having now seen how many of these working at local level are just so strongly committed to getting on top of the outbreak and in some cases are putting their lives at risk, I just wanted to share with you my own sense. Yes, they are the heroes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave. We don't have much time, so if you could limit yourself to...
I talked too long. Sorry.
One question. Evelyn?
Yes, thank you very much. I welcome you on behalf of the United Nations Correspondents Association. I'm Evelyn Leopold. My question is, we hear stories, especially in Liberia, of beds being empty because there are not enough health workers, either foreign or domestic, and they're not being paid enough. So I'm wondering if you could comment on that. And also that they can't, people can't get an aspirin. You can have Ebola and possibly get treated, but not if you're pregnant.
Thanks very much, and nice to be greeted by you. The first thing is that we have really invested in making sure there are a lot more beds to treat people. And the first stage has been to build the hospitals, special kinds of hospitals for Ebola treatment, not like any other hospital you'll ever see. And we also have to have health workers to run the hospitals, and these health workers have to be well-equipped, and they have to be given extra training. at the moment, the vast majority of the newly constructed hospitals in Liberia are staffed with personnel and are able to receive patients. In fact, there is currently, fortunately, an overcapacity of beds in parts of Liberia. But that's exactly what I want to see. I want to see functioning hospitals that are not full, because that means that the situation is improving. Now, we have other situations, particularly in Sierra Leone West Side, where we are short of functioning beds, partly because we haven't got enough workers ready trained. They're all being given the last training before they do the work. And I am confident that that problem will be resolved in the coming weeks. There is, as you say, an issue with health services. Actually, in both Liberia and Sierra Leone, the numbers of health centres that are open is greatly increasing, in Liberia particularly, because the situation doesn't seem to be as bad now as it was about 2 months ago. And yes, I agree with you, it's unfortunate that for many women who are pregnant, it's not easy to get help, and we are really focused on getting health services back and working again. They have been places of danger and places where people have got ill, and that's one of the reasons why they were shut, but they're opening up. But thanks for the reminder.
Edie?
Thank you, Dr. Navarro. Edith Lederer from the Associated Press. The World Health Organization in September had set a target of zero transmissions by January 1st. From what you have said, it looks like that will go over into 2015. Could you tell us why, and could you also comment on the president of Sierra Leone's comment today, President Karoma, saying that he hoped to end all Ebola transmissions in the next 21 days, considering that they've been having between 400 and 500 a week.
So thank you. The I may have read what WHO said, Edie Lederer, differently from you, because my understanding was that there would be zero transmission in some locations by the beginning of January, and they picked out particularly some of the urban locations, but I don't think it was zero transmission throughout the region. And so from my point of view, actually we're not doing that badly, because we are now seeing increasing numbers of areas where there is very low or even zero transmission, particularly in rural Liberia and also in eastern Sierra Leone. But yes, there are other areas where transmission is still quite high, and that is a cause of concern, because if it's high in any part of the region, it can come back. We've seen that before. So we have to keep working on it until it's all gone. And this virus is not actually predictable. We never quite know where it's going to show up next. And so it's always a case of getting as many people on the ground as possible to respond efficiently as they can. And I'm most impressed by President Karoma's determination. It's quite possible that transmission will end in the not-distant future in Sierra Leone if the number of treatment beds that are open and working is according to the current plan, i.e. if we get several hundred open and working before the end of this year, and also if there is not a great deal of movement of people who are infected bringing the disease into new places. So I'm utterly keen to encourage the Sierra Leone government in that particular quest. And I'm being a little bit cautious myself of setting sort of predictive targets for when it's going to be to a particular stage of completion, just because it seems to have a habit of coming back and alarming us. But I would back His Excellency President Karoma as much as I could, because I think the one thing I've learnt from him is that he has real determination, and when he says these things, he follows them through.
Thank you. People's Daily? Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. People's Daily. Mr. Lee from People's Daily. I went to the Global Compact meeting this morning, and the Global Compact also encourages private sectors to contribute more to the fighting of Ebola. Does it mean that the private sector does not contribute more enough to the response of Ebola?
Well, thank you, and I was glad you were there. For me, I don't think it's a case ever of telling people they don't give enough. I think it's more saying there are opportunities for business to contribute, and we're seeing those, and we're encouraging more to look at those opportunities. Let's consider the mining sector, a very important employer, a very important contributor to the economies of all three countries, but at the same time a sector where there has been some concern and fear, and indeed a number of the personnel have left the region. So what I'm suggesting is that once the staff are confident that they can return without putting their employees at high levels of risk, please come back quickly, please restart your work, please get money back into the economy, because this makes a huge difference to people's lives and livelihoods. Business can help stabilize local economies that have been badly hit by the outbreak, and so I'm encouraging business to come in as soon as it can and to contribute in that way. And I did mention just now that I'm finding that businesses also have a fantastic impact through encouraging their employees to keep safe, and then those employees then affecting their families and communities. So business, in this example, is really good for the overall control and recovery effort.
Matthew.
Sure, thanks a lot. Matthew Lee, Intercity Press, on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access. Thanks for doing the briefing when you get back. I wanted to ask, in covering the session in ECOSOC on Friday, there seemed to be some problems with pledges converting themselves into actual financing arriving, particularly in Sierra Leone and maybe some other countries. What's your experience of there have been high numbers pledged? What percentage of this is actually reaching the countries? And also there have been some reports of journalists and others, but I'll ask about journalists, being somehow at times cracked down on either for their reporting of new cases or their criticizing of governments for their thing. There was a journalist in Sierra Leone that was locked up for just this. Is this a trend? What's the right balance between freedom of the press and public health? Thank you.
Well, thanks very much indeed. In general, I like to see full and open information about any issue, and so I'm a supporter of transparency. At the same time, I've heard frustration from government officials who sometimes conclude that reporting has not covered the full situation. So there are inevitably anxieties, particularly given that there are so many distressing issues around this. I cannot comment on any specific issue or allegation. In terms of conversion of pledges to finance, yes, it is important that the pledges become liquid cash as quickly as possible. I'm particularly looking at this in the regard to the Secretary General's Trust Fund, the information about the pledges that have been made and those that have actually been deposited as cash is available on a website for the Trust Fund. And there are one or two pledges that have not yet materialized, and I wish they would. But in general, Matthew, I would say that on this issue, the pledges are coming through as cash. That's a general positive feeling about it. Thank you.
In some area in the region, people are using mobile phone tackling the disease. Is there any success on that way?
Mobile phones are great. I'll tell you why. Bye-bye.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. I do it all the time. Thank you. Mobile phones are great because three things. One, obviously you can communicate what's happening with yourself. If you're ill, you can call for an ambulance, you can call for advice, and in fact there are helplines now that have been opened up And I'm really pleased with these helplines, but they've had a bit of a rocky start, but now I think they're getting much better. There are some prank calls, but if we put those aside, they're the best way in which members of the public get access to help. Number two, you can use a mobile phone for reporting the location of somebody who's ill through GPS, through the location part of a phone, and that's absolutely great. So smartphones are increasingly being used for that. And thirdly, you can use the mobile phone as a way of providing health advice and guidance in local language through sending synchronized text messages or other mechanisms. So this has been an example. Unfortunately, coverage is a bit sparse in some parts of the region, but it at least goes to show that now mobile phones are a key part of the public health response.
Matthew?
Hi, my name is Matthew Carpenter. I'm a reporter for Yomiuri Shimbun, a Japanese newspaper. My question is, other than cash, what kind of equipment and hard aid are you requiring at this point?
So the majority of requirements are, number one, clothing for treating people who are ill. That's personal protective equipment. It's been donated very generously by Japan, plus also other requirements for infection prevention like chlorine and so on. Number two, we need vehicles, quite a lot of vehicles, and we still need vehicles for various purposes, transporting people, whether they're sick or well, transporting people who've died for burial, and also transporting goods. Number three, we do need fuel in order to make sure that the vehicles keep on the road. Number four, we need quite a lot of help with things like portable accommodation so that people can stay out at district level and also sometimes for constructing community care centres. Number five, we do need to have communications equipment, including cell phones. We've had a number of kind donations of cell phones from manufacturers and others. Those are the kind of requirements that we need. I can, if necessary, arrange that you are sent the list of equipment that we have. The equipment needs that we have.
Thank you. Sangwon, that'll have to be the last question, unfortunately, because we have to release Dr. Nabarro.
Hello, Sangwon from Bloomberg News. What longer-term plans do you have, considering the lessons you've learned in this epidemic, so that the UN system or the WHO can be bolstered to prevent any further epidemics from breaking out in the future, i.e. bolstering the
epidemiology? There are two parts to the answer to this question. Number one is actually the security and capacity to avoid these kinds of outbreaks has to be built up within countries, by governments, by local civil society groups, involving not just medical doctors but also epidemiologists and other special scientists who can do this kind of work. Number two is we need international systems that link together countries, either regionally or globally or both, and that's where the World Health Organization has a key role to play. Of course, I think as we look at the causes and consequences of this outbreak, we see that the international work just has been severely underfunded for years. I've been working in crisis challenges for three decades now, and I've learnt that in between crises, it's quite hard to get money for preparedness and for readiness. So what I'm anticipating is that after this one, we must move very quickly to persuade governments to get money and other political support into preparation for responses.
Great. Thank you very much. I know we'll get David back.
I just worried for this lady who had hand for ages.
Thank you so much.
See, I'm no good at... I have no firm lines in my life. Yeah.
I'm Anna. On behalf of ICAS News, Dr. Nabarro, I just wanted to thank you for your efforts and optimism. And I wanted to ask about vaccine research. It's been reported that Russian scientists have been doing this research on vaccines, which was based on monoclonal antibodies specific against Ebola. And it's been proven very effective, especially within 24 hours of administering, which is crucial. There is research undergoing in many other countries. Yes. Is UN monitoring this somehow?
Yes, absolutely.
And how important the vaccine research is? And also one little addendum to this question. It's been reported, it's been stated that in this global race against Ebola, lots of things fell through cracks. Could you please identify these cracks and tell us about the ways to mend them?
Thank you. Let me start on vaccines. There have been several candidate vaccines that have appeared in the last few years, and some of these are now being subject to intensive testing through the different phases of vaccine development. And we anticipate that if the testing goes well, we will have vaccines available in the middle of next year, which will complement the other aspects of the response that I've described. I'm sure that during coming months, there will be many inquiries done, because this has been a really serious, massive outbreak that's affected so many people. At this stage, I am solely focused on completing the response, and so it's not going to be for me now to make any comment on this. But I'm sure that that further work, the post-mortem, as we call it, will be put into place as soon as the outbreak is over. Thanks very much,
Thank
everybody.
You. Good.